few days, but then, as I guess is common knowledge, we don't live in a place that has high temperatures every day. So when heat does come, it affects people much more harshly than it would in someone that lives in southern climates. So it was 31 and 31, I believe, last Saturday and Sunday, and Monday was quite hot too. And now it's cooled down, but with cooling comes the clouds, and it leads to my first story, which is the planetary alignment. So that's one thing I was looking forward to. With the bad clouds, or with the bad skies, with the clouds, we couldn't see the planetary alignment. But I did the other night, and I did last night, so it was interesting. Doing this show on Tuesday, so it's not like I'm talking the night before the show. So there was some planetary alignments. It was nice to see. I woke up about 4 in the morning twice to view them, and I think if I had more patience, I would have stayed up longer, but I didn't see Venus and I didn't see Mercury. I didn't take out my telescopes. Which night exactly it was, but Mars was close to the moon, so that was very beautiful. And you can see Jupiter and Saturn in the sky. So it is one of the highlights of, or it will be one of the highlights of my summer, because I will be able to say I saw the planetary alignment. So it was very nice to see. And there's going to be some more planetary alignments, and our the planets are still aligned, and I'm talking to you on Tuesday, which is the 28th, and I'm going to try to see if I can see it tonight. But it is called an epic five planet alignment, and that's what the title is from LiveScience.com. The best ever view of an epic five planet alignment is happening this week, and this article is dated by Brandon Spector 6 days ago, so talking in 28th, so it was dated the 22nd. But we can still see the planetary alignment, and it goes in order from Mercury to Venus, then Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and the Moon. So this, it doesn't say the date that this particular order happened in, because on some of the days last week, the Moon was moving, and as I said, it was by Mars. And on this photograph, it's just ahead of Saturn. So the moon moved through this arc that the planets are on. And it says epic because it doesn't happen often. The sky hasn't looked like this since 1864. So that's about 156 years. I don't know when the five planet alignment will happen again. So try to catch it this week if you can, because right now, as I said, I'm speaking to you on the 28th, and it probably won't be around for much longer. So as I said, and as everybody knows, it was the first day of summer, Tuesday. So that is 1 week ago from when I'm speaking. I think it was on the 21st. And then in a few more months, it'll start getting cooler again. So get out there. Get out there and 4 in the morning to go see the planetary alignment. And as I said, I'm not as enthusiastic about pulling my telescope out, but you never know, I might. But I had a chance to pull out one of my two telescopes the other night, and I didn't on both of the nights. So, but I've seen a lot of the planets before in telescopes, especially Jupiter and Saturn, and it looks spectacular when you look at it. But then I thought, on my telescope, they're not good, really good telescopes. They're not expensive telescope. So to find the planet, align it on your telescope and look at it would be nice. But then, as the Earth rotates, then the planet goes out of view. So you got to keep changing the position of your telescope. And if I had some kind of mechanism on there which rotates the telescope in unison with the Earth, then I wouldn't have to do that. But as I said, you'd have to take a look at one planet at a time, and I doubt if you could see Mercury. And if you see Venus, it probably moves so fast and it will come out of existence, or come out of your it sorry let me so try to say that again as the sun rises, Venus vanishes, so it's not even worth trying to focus on Venus. But what I could do is, I just thought of that now, but I thought of that the other day too, go out on my porch, on my patio on the 11th floor, and take a look at the planets through my binoculars. So I might do that tonight. So anyway, just to remind you again, I don't know how long this planetary alignment will continue, but it's very nice to see the planets align like this. But then it takes a bit of patience, and I didn't have enough patience. I guess it's 4 a.m. It's hard to have patience when you want to go back to sleep. So anyway, I'm going to read this article now. And as I said, it was 6 days ago, but we could still get a lot of information. This is by Brandon Spector, and it's on livescience.com. The name of the article is "The Best Ever View of an Epic 5-Planet Alignment is Happening This Week." And something else I'm going to read about our solar system. There's sunspots and solar flares and all this. So one sunspot is apparently looking right at us. So that could be a problem for Earth. We'll see. So this article again, "The Best Ever View of an Epic 5-Planet Alignment is Happening This Week." It's by Brandon Spector on livescience.com. Published 6 days ago, so it's published June 22nd, one day after summer started. And it says, "The sky hasn't looked like this since 1864. And one article of news, solstice, when the longest day of the year, there was sunlight for almost 16 hours, 15 hours, 59 minutes and some odd seconds. And that's going to go down every time. But that was nice to have all this daylight. And hopefully the Earth will start to warm up more and we'll get better weather every day. Other than this, today it feels very chilly. It's Tuesday. Right now it's about 8:46 p.m. and I just looked at the Weather Channel. It's 16 degrees Celsius, so that does seem a bit cool compared to the 31 degrees that we had on the previous weekend. So here goes this article. "It's officially summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and half of the solar system wants to get in on the action. For the remainder of June, stargazers taking the red-eye shift will be able to see 5 planets line up in the pre-dawn sky: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Remarkably, the planets will appear in order of their proximity to the Sun, with Mercury visible closest to the horizon, while the other planets are neatly across the southern and eastern skies." So you look across the eastern sky, you can see this, and it says here, the pre-dawn sky. "From Thursday, June 23rd to Saturday, June 25th, Earth's moon will also join the planetary parade, creating an exceptionally rare procession of celestial bodies. According to Live Science's sister site, space.com, a planetary alignment like this one hasn't occurred since March 5th, 1864, 158 years ago. And isn't that beautiful that we as a species can predict these things, predict eclipses, predict all these things that animals cannot predict. But then there's some things animals can feel in their bodies, like, for example, the, I don't know if it's called S waves, but some kind of waves from a earthquake, they can feel it. I think we have that capability. Our knees have some sensors, I believe, but we don't translate to that brain, translate to our brain. It doesn't, like the animals, when they feel the sensations, then their brain interprets it and says, oh, there's danger coming. Where our sensors don't transmit that same sense of danger to the brain. I hope I said that correctly. So we have all these, all this knowledge of planetary things and hundreds and thousands of years. And for example, we know when the North Pole or the North Star is going to change to a different star. We know how long it's going to take for many astronomical things to happen, so that's great. So from Thursday, June 23rd to Saturday, June 25th, Earth's moon will also join the planetary parade. So I mentioned that because I saw it when Mars was at the, it was like a crescent moon, a sliver of a moon, and at the point of its, at the bottom, it was close to the planet Mars, and it looked really nice. And then, of course, you can see the two big giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn. And I could have seen Mercury, but I was kind of sleepy. So let's say if I can force myself to stay awake tonight or the next few nights, and I'll see what it looks like. While the five-planet alignment has been visible for much of June, the view improved significantly during the last few weeks of the month, Space.com added. The show begins a bit after midnight when Saturn becomes visible to the naked eye, followed by Jupiter, Mars, and Venus over the following hours. Roughly 30 minutes before sunup, Mercury will finally join the party, completing the epic alignment. So I wish that this told us whether you can see Mercury with your binoculars or just even the naked eye, but I don't know. It's hard to. I believe Mercury is called an inferior planet because it is inside of Earth's orbit, so that would tell me Venus is also an inferior planet to Earth, that is, anyway. So I'm trying to recall, and I don't think I've ever seen Mercury, so I should try to force myself to see if I can see Mercury. But I did one time, quite a few years ago, I had a telescope and I believe I saw Uranus. So that was very exciting. And of course, Jupiter and Saturn are always there and nice to see. They're really, Saturn is just like you think, you look through your telescope and someone put a picture from the internet on it. It's so nice. From June 23rd to June 25th, a small crescent moon will sneak between Venus and Mars as if standing in Earth in the pre-dawn planetary lineup. To get the best view of the alignment, stargazers should find a spot with a clear view of the horizon forward or towards the east, according to NPR, whoever that is. Binoculars or a telescope are recommended. If you miss the alignment this year, you won't have another chance to see the five-planet lineup in sequential order until 2040, NPR added. So I guess at the beginning of this article, it said this is the first of its kind in about 186 years. So maybe there's another five-planet alignment, but maybe it won't be that good. After June, the planets will gradually start to go their separate ways, with Saturn, Mars, Jupiter, and Venus starting to appear more spread out in the sky, according to NASA. By September, Venus and Saturn will no longer be visible to most observers in the morning hours, so catch them while you can. And of course, as I said, this is a rare planetary alignment, just what this is, once in every 186 years, so I guess a lot of us will not be able to see this kind of planetary alignment if we miss this one. So I think it's very nice to try to make an effort to see it, because I did and it was very nice. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play a video. Let's see, I'm going live, so maybe if it doesn't happen, then I'll be embarrassed. So let's see what this video is about. It's about the orbit of Mercury, so I'm waiting for it, but of course my computer is not cooperating with me, so hopefully I'll give it a couple more seconds and hopefully it will play a nice video about Mercury's strange orbit. So that's what it said. Okay, I'm going to have to read it because it's subtitles. Over the last 4.5 billion years, the Sun has shaped every planet in our solar system. Each planet is connected to the Sun through an invisible web, the Sun's magnetic field. Though every planet experiences the Sun's magnetism, they do so from very different distances. how does the sun's impact change across space? There's one planet giving us clues.
So Mercury's special not just because it's the closest planet to the sun, but also because the distance it is from the sun varies more than any other planet in our solar system. Mercury actually has a very oval-shaped orbit compared to the rest.
Mercury is a natural laboratory for running experiments. We can observe the planet's surroundings as it gets closer and further away from the sun and see what changes.
Roberto and Ginelli look to Mercury with the following questions. How does the sun's impact change throughout the year? A stream of particles races out from the sun into space. Scientists call it the solar wind. But Mercury has a shield. The planet's magnetosphere shows and deflects.
When solar wind particles bounce off this magnetospheric boundary, they generate low-frequency waves. They're like ripples traveling upstream in the solar wind.
Using data from NASA's Messenger mission, Roberto and Gina watch these waves change throughout Mercury's orbit. The farther Mercury was from the sun, the more waves Messenger detected.
Further from the sun, the sun's magnetic field is weaker. We found that this is the key parameter that allows more waves to be generated.
The solar wind ultimately pushes the waves back towards Mercury, where they add energy. Although Mercury doesn't have an atmosphere, these waves occur at other planets that do. In the long run, the energy from these waves can change the planet's atmosphere. Mercury's waves help us understand how planets interact with stars, including those beyond Mercury.
This is something we could only have measured with Mercury, thanks to how close it is to the sun and the shape of its orbit.
Learning about our sun's... I'm going to talk about the sun and solar flares and things like that. Thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASA UBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. So I have a goal now. If there's a clear sky, I'm going to try to get at least at least my binoculars out to try to see what I can see. The other nights when it was hot, it was beautifully clear sky, and I did see two nights where I saw the planetary alignment, so it's worth seeing. And Jupiter and Saturn, I thought, were quite far apart, and as this article says, they will get farther apart as the month and progresses and goes into July. And I think by September, some of the planets won't be in alignment anymore, and maybe the moon won't be in that particular alignment. So try to go see it, unless you plan to live 186 more years so you can see the next great planetary alignment. I'm now going to talk about solar storms, and I guess we take it for granted that we are in danger of being hit by a solar storm. And there's quite a few spacecraft, if a solar storm does happen and if it's danger on the way, they'll alert. But I don't know what we can do to prevent the big solar storm hitting us and preventing damage. I'm not sure, but here I will read this article. It says, surprise solar storm with disruptive potential slams into Earth. And this, obviously, if it slammed into Earth already, then it hit us. I thought there was more coming, but anyway, I will read this one first. Surprise solar storm with disruptive potential slams into Earth. And there's an article I was reading earlier on before I came on to the show about the rockets, the SpaceX rockets, and it reminds me of something that Elon Musk said. We need reusable rockets if ever there's going to be an attempt to go to Mars and return the spacecraft, to return people from there. So I'm going to read that later, but first let's get to the sun. I think there's two articles about the sun, and again, this one's called, it's by Harry Barker, about 11 hours ago. So right now as I'm reading, it is the 28th, so it happened on the 28th, this article. It's on livescience.com, and again, surprise solar storm with disruptive potential slams into Earth. And the subtitle says, experts were initially unsure what caused the freak geomagnetic event. And here's an illustration, and it says, a stream of supercharged particles from the sun recently crashed into Earth with no prior warning. Oh, that's an interesting thing, no prior warning. And I was blabbing about a minute ago that here's all these spacecrafts or observatories out there and people working on it to give us prior warning, but this one hit us with no prior warning. So we'll see what this article says. Scientists were recently left scratching their heads after a potentially disruptive solar storm smashed into Earth without warning. The surprise solar storm hit Earth just before midnight, UTC June 25th. I should know what UTC means, but I don't. And continued throughout most of June 26th, according to spaceweather.com. Oh, there's spaceweather.com. Maybe I should check into that. Scientists classified it as a G1 class storm, which means it was strong enough to create weak power, grid fluctuations, cause major impacts to satellite operation, disrupt the navigational abilities of some migrating animals, and cause unusually strong auroras. The unexpected solar storm coincided with the peak of an extremely rare five-planet alignment where Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn lined up in the early sky in order of their proximity to the Sun, which hasn't happened since 1864. So maybe that is what's unique about this, is that this planetary alignment, the planets line up in the sky in order of their proximity to the Sun. Maybe there's other times where there might be a planetary alignment, but the planets aren't featured in their order from the sun, but this one is, so maybe that's what's different about it. Amateur astronomers in the northern hemisphere were able to capture images of surprise auroras as they photobombed the neatly aligned planets. So they did photobomb the neatly aligned. That would have been nice to see, wouldn't it? I bet a lot of amateur astronomers who are very good caught that too. Photographer Harlan Thomas captured an image of bright auroras in Calgary, Canada, which flashed across the dawn sky in front of the planetary alignment on June 26. So says Thomas, and quote, wow, talk about surprises. The aurora became visible to the naked eye with beautiful pillars and lasted around 5 minutes, end quote, Thomas said. And here's a related article, ancient solar storm smashed the Earth at the wrong part of the sun cycle, and scientists are concerned. Scientists initially suspected coronal mass ejection, CME, caused the freak storm, a large lump of plasma with an embedded magnetic field that is belched out from a sunspot, but they couldn't tell if it had occurred on the Earth side or far side of the sun, according to spaceweather.com. However, experts now blame a much rarer co-rotating interaction region, CIR, of the sun. These are transition zones between slow and fast moving streams of solar wind, according to spaceweather.com. Isn't it amazing how much there is to know about astronomy? Wow. These waves create buildups of plasma that can suddenly unleash shockwaves that are similar to CMEs, but don't cause sunspots, which makes them much harder to detect on the sun's surface. The solar wind that blasted Earth on June 25th and 26th peaked at around 1.57 million miles per hour, or 2.52 million kilometers per hour, which is consistent with other CIRs in the past, according to spaceweather.com. So let's get that new word, co-rotating interaction region, CIR, of the sun. These are transition zones between slow and fast moving streams of solar winds. Okay. The surprise solar storm hit Earth less than a week after a gigantic sunspot known as capital A, capital R 3038 doubled in size over a 24-hour period and reached a maximum diameter more than 2.5 times the size of the Earth. So this sunspot, or the solar storm, was 2.5 times the size of the Earth. Pretty neat. The giant sunspot sparked fears of a potentially damaging CME hitting our planet, but the spot eventually aimed away from Earth as the sun rotated. Scientists don't know if the gargantuan sunspot and the solar storm are connected. So everybody will recall when they're saying, like Proxima Centauri, the size of those stars, they are more eruptive and they have a lot more sunspots. So some of the planets that are targets for scientists who believe that we can go to another star system and establish some kind of presence on that star system, one of these planets, those stars, which make up 70% of the stars in the galaxy, are, and probably in the universe, are temperamental, and they can have many solar flares or sunspots or coronal mass ejections, many a day, even up to 200 a day or hundreds a day. So we are looking at something that could be very damaging to life, and scientists who believe we can establish a presence on another star system, or in another star system, on a planet, well, that has to be taken into account, isn't it? Because these solar storms are not fun, are they? The great sunspot sparked fears of a potentially damaging CME hitting our planet, but the spot eventually aimed away from Earth as the sun rotated. Scientists don't know if the gigantic sunspot and the solar storm are connected. So that's what I do sometimes. I read and then I make some comments, I blab on, and repeat the last two sentences so we don't lose track. So here is a beautiful aurora. It is an example of the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis in Norway. So those were visible to all these great astronomers, even the amateur astronomers that are really dedicated to this and have easy access to bring their telescopes out. And I think if you had a backyard in a nice part of the city where it's not too much light pollution, and if you had somewhere you could store your telescope, then you could just walk out there at night and open the, I forget what it's called, open the roof, let's say, and use your telescope. Different than me. I live in the city and then I don't want to drag my telescope out. Auroras occur when charged particles from solar winds slam into oxygen, hydrogen molecules in Earth's upper atmosphere, which ionizes these molecules and causes them to glow. Normally, auroras are confined to regions around the North and South Poles, where Earth's magnetic field deflects these particles its weakest. But during solar storms, aurora can become much brighter and can be seen at much lower altitudes than normal. In November 2021, a powerful solar storm produced color displays in the United States as far south as Pennsylvania, Iowa, and Oregon, because scientists initially believed the recent solar storm could have been caused by a far-side CME. They predicted that the unusual auroras could last until June 29th. However, solar wind activity has now returned to normal. And another thing I learned tonight was that LiveScience.com and Space.com are sister stations, or sister websites, however you want to put it. On Space.com, they do sell telescopes and things, so if you want to look at a telescope, go ahead. There's a place in New York, it's called Adorama. I ordered one of my telescopes from there and some of my eyepieces, but when that happened, that was quite a few years ago, and I had friends and cousins that lived in Seattle, so I would go pick them up because I go to Seattle often. But now if I don't even think they ship to Vancouver, and if they do, it wouldn't be worth it. But I also went to some telescope shops in LA and in Seattle, and the prices are quite a few lower, so I don't know, quite a bit lower, so I don't know what it would be like trying to cross the border. But one of my friends says, keep your eye on the want ads. If you have patience, all of a sudden there's somebody that either found a telescope in their attic or inherited one or just want to get rid of it, and you can get an incredibly good deal if you hit the newspaper at the right time. And now I say newspaper, but now I can say the internet, and you can find an incredibly good deal. So don't have the patience for that. On the same website, livescience.com, on a related article, there's an article that says giant sunspot double in size in 24 hours, and it's pointing right at Earth. It's by Ken Turner, and it's published 6 days ago, which is June 26th, one day after the beginning of summer. Here's a subtitle: Earth will remain in the sunspot's crosshairs for a few more days. So again, the name of this article is Giant Sunspot Double in Size in 24 Hours, and it's pointing right at Earth. Here is two massive sunspot groups pictured on the sun's surface. So I guess these are real pictures, not an artist impression. And you can see them. Ooh, they look scary. Again, this article is called Giant Sunspot Double in Size in 24 Hours, and it's pointing right at Earth, by Ben Turner, published June 22nd. A gigantic sunspot has swelled to twice Earth's size, doubling its diameter in 24 hours, and it's pointed right at us. The sunspot, called AR3038, grew to 2.5 times Earth's size, making the sunspot roughly 19,800 miles, or 31,900 kilometers in diameter, from Sunday, June 19th to Monday, June 20th. So I guess this article is related to that previous article I read, but it's not the same article, according to spaceweather.com, a website that tracks news about solar flares, geomagnetic storms, and other cosmic weather events. Sunspots are dark patches on the sun's surface where powerful magnetic fields created by the flow of electrical charges from the sun's plasma knot before suddenly snapping. The resulting release of energy launches bursts of radiation called solar flares and generates explosive jets of solar material called coronal mass ejections, CMEs. So says spaceweather.com, and quote, yesterday sunspot AR3038 was big. Today it's enormous. The fast-growing sunspot has doubled in size in only 24 hours. AR3038 has an unstable beta-gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for M-class medium-sized solar flares, and it is directly facing Earth, end quote. When a solar flare hits Earth's upper atmosphere, the flare's X-rays and ultraviolet radiation ionize atoms, making it impossible to bounce high-frequency radio waves off them and creating a so-called radio blackout. Radio blackouts occur over the area on Earth that are lit by the sun while a flare is underway. Such blackouts are classified from R1 to R5 according to ascending severity. So I'm going to read part of that again because that is so cool. When a solar flare hits Earth's upper atmosphere, the flare's X-rays and ultraviolet radiation ionize atoms. In April and May, two solar flares caused R3 blackouts over the Atlantic Ocean, Australia, and Asia, Life Science previously reported. As solar flares travel at the speed of light, they take only 8 minutes to reach us from an average distance of about 93 million miles, or 150 million kilometers. If An Earth-facing sunspot forms near the Sun's equator, where AR3038 is located. It typically takes just under 2 weeks for it to travel across the Sun so that it's no longer facing Earth, according to spaceweatherlive.com. Currently, AR3038 lies slightly to the north of the Sun's equator and is just over halfway across, so Earth will remain in its crosshairs for a few more days. So let's see if I can get a link here, because what I want to do is open a link to, oh, here, okay, so I'm hoping a link to spaceweather.com, because this has enticed me to go to that website. I never knew it existed. Looks like a very nice video, and let's see what the video is about.
Like, this one, like, a cannibal coronal mass ejection, like, if I break that down for you, It's caused by sunspots. So there's a sunspot on the Sun called, like, AR2975 right now.
Okay.
And what it's been doing over the last, say, like, few days is producing up to 17 solar eruptions, two of which have headed straight towards us. Now, one of them was traveling faster than the other. It was the one just, like, that came just after the first one that was emitted. Now, when that second coronal mass ejection caught up with the first, it cannibalized it. It swept it all up into this one big wave of these charged particles, and then they all swept towards the Earth, and then when they hit it, they caused a geomagnetic storm. Where they come from in how sunspots are created is magnetic fields are created on the Sun. Like, the Sun is just a giant ball of plasma, so, like, there's loads of charged particles eddying and moving around on, like, inside the Sun, across the Sun's surface. Now, when you have charged particles moving, you're going to induce some magnetism there. But because magnetic field lines can't cross, and you've got all these moving particles, like this giant traffic jam of particles moving everywhere, you'll inevitably get these field lines bunched up next to each other. They'll form into these tight knots that can't escape anywhere else, and eventually they will have to snap and release energy. Now, they release energy either in the form of a solar flare, like a bright flare of radiation, or they'll release energy in the form of, like, chucking out some of that plasma from the Sun.
What's the difference between solar flares and coronal mass ejections?
So solar flares is just the bright flash that you'll see of radiation,
okay,
from that field line snapping that energy release. A coronal mass ejection is some of the Sun's, like, plasma soup being, like, burped out of the Sun.
I love that phrase, plasma soup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tasty plasma soup.
Pretty, but, I mean, a little terrifying, right?
Well, thank you for listening to that video. I have to apologize. I meant to line up the video, move on to the article. In April and May, two solar flares caused R3 blackouts over the Atlantic Ocean. Despite its alarming speedy growth, the giant sunspot is less scary than it may seem. The flares it will most likely produce are M-class solar flares, which generally cause brief radio blackouts that affect Earth's polar regions, alongside minor radiation storms, the European Space Agency wrote in a blog. M-class flares are the most common type of solar flares. Although the Sun does occasionally release enormous X-class flares, the strongest category with the potential to cause high-frequency blackouts on the side of Earth that's exposed to the flare. These flares are observed much less often than smaller solar eruptions. It was intriguing to know that sometimes, well, when I was younger, I would watch TV and some of the static you'd get on TV. And in between stations, when your screen would have all these waves, that was actually the Big Bang that you'd be seeing, the radiation from the Big Bang. So sometimes I wonder if I'm watching TV or listening to something on a radio, which a lot of us don't do anymore, whether the static you have is that part of the Big Bang, or is that some kind of atmospheric thing happening that is causing these little disruptions. And I will come back. And then when I do, I will read more. I think I'm going to go to the section where I'm going to talk about the rockets, because the rockets, if you look into it, they can be very complicated, very complex. Thank you for listening. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Do you hear what I'm hearing?
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. I'm just living my dream. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com. For everybody who should live it, live it, live it. Go and
get it, you should live it, live it, live it. Welcome back. This is Marco. You listen to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I did want to get to the Artemis rockets because the rockets, as we know right now, are our way to get off this planet and out of the gravitational field of the Earth. So when they were going to the moon, they had big, big giant rockets, and they're much more complicated than we think. It's just not like a firecracker where you light the fuse and boom. The development of rockets was an interesting thing to read about, and I read about that, and they are going to need big rockets to get to the moon and to get to Mars. So I wanted to look at that for sure, but first I wanted to just review James Webb Space Telescope, because it was promised in July that we're going to have our first images. And here, there's an article on space.com that says, James Webb Space Telescope scientists prepare for first operational images. Listen in Wednesday. That is really cool. So, by Elizabeth Howell, about 12 hours ago, so it's published June 28th. Here is the article. Get excited for July 12th. And here's a video here, and it says NASA Live, official stream of NASA TV, where you can listen to this. Join in free Wednesday, June 29th, as NASA celebrates the forthcoming end of commissioning in its $10 billion Next Generational Space Observatory. So that's tomorrow. Ooh. So go to space.com and I'll read this article again and you can listen in. It's called James Webb Space Telescope Scientists Prepare for First Operational Images. Listen in Wednesday. In a series of talks, the agency plans to discuss the James Webb Space Telescope and its aims to uncover more about the early universe, solar system objects, exoplanets, and a range of interesting things around the universe. So we know one of the benefits of Webb is they're going to be able to look at earlier in the universe and gain a lot more knowledge about it. And they're also going to be able to, something to do with Mars. I read about it, or I broadcast on this show many months ago, something to do with Mars. It's going to help study Mars better. So that's pretty cool. We can go from Mars to the beginning of time, which is, I don't know, it's called the time of creation. NASA will broadcast audio from the event held in Baltimore at the Space Telescope Science Institute starting at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time or 1400 GMT. So GMT looks like 4 hours ahead of Eastern Daylight Time. You can tune in here. I get Greenwich Mean Time. Okay, I don't know if that's UCT time. You can tune in here courtesy of NASA or directly at the agency's website. And here's a video. What does it say? It is called, oh, the video already started playing, and it says play sound if you want, but I will wait until this commercial ends and I will see what this video is about, because it, the view from here, okay, no, so I'm not going to play this. Participants include NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy, and Thomas Zurbuchen, Associate Administrator for NASA Science Mission Directorate. In addition to the event, will include two panels. One will be dedicated to science topics, and the other will highlight the observatory's commissioning process and design. The talks come 2 weeks before NASA unveils the first science quality images from the observatory. So tomorrow's just the presentation about all these things that Webb is going to do and the future, its future its future missions, and in 2 weeks' time will be the first pictures. Webb launched December 25th, 2021, and has been working to prepare each of its four scientific instruments for operation. You can follow along with the instruments checkoff list on the Where is Webb NASA webpage. Okay, so that's exciting news about Webb. It didn't seem like it took 6 months since Webb would launch before these the final day came, but it looks like we're almost there. Okay, so there's something called the Capstone Probe, and it says, why will it take so long for NASA's Capstone Probe to reach the moon? The little spacecraft has a big journey ahead of it. NASA's 55-pound, 25-kilogram Capstone CubeSat launched today, June 28th. So, this is today, it's June 28th, Thursday, rising into the sky from New Zealand atop a Rocket Lab Electron booster. Capstone is bound for the moon, but it won't get there until November 13th. The moon is just 238,900 miles, or 384,500 kilometers from Earth, a mere stone's throw on the scale of our solar system. NASA's crewed Apollo missions made the trip in just 3 days, so why will it take Capstone more than 4 months? So says it's all about the rockets. The Apollo spacecraft launched atop NASA's enormous Saturn V, the most powerful rocket ever to fly. Though the agency's Space Launch System, Mega Rocket, and SpaceX's Starship vehicle could soon change that. The microwave oven-sized Capstone, by contrast, lifted off on Electron, a 59-foot-tall or 118-meters launcher designed to give small satellites rides to Earth orbit. The Capstone team therefore had to get creative, choosing a much more fuel-efficient route into Earth's nearest neighbor. The route, known as Ballistic Lunar Transfer Trajectory, BLT, like a sandwich, turned out to be quite circuitous and time-consuming. BLT, that's a good way to remember this. Ballistic Lunar Transfer, it's like a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. So now I know BLT means Ballistic Lunar Transfer. So says representatives of the Colorado company Advanced Space, which is operating the Capstone mission under a NASA contract. And quote, BLTs are a type of low energy transfer in which a spacecraft launches 1 to 2 million kilometers, 600,000 to 1.2 million miles away from the Earth, where the sun's gravity perturbation becomes dominant, then returns to Earth with a larger radius of perigee than before and a different geocentric orbit plane. Okay, that's easy for them to say, but whatever that means. When designed with the proper geometry, it is possible to choose the perigee to coincide with the moon's orbit, bringing the spacecraft into the vicinity of the moon. End quote. Capstone's BLT will take it 810,000 miles, or 1.3 million kilometers from our planet, before the CubeSat is pulled back towards the Earth-Moon system. Rocket Lab representatives wrote in the mission press kit, which you can find here. The spacecraft will then slip into its desired orbit around the moon on November 13th. So I apologize, I don't think I said the name of this article. And the name of the article was Why It'll Take NASA's Tiny Capstone Probe So Long to Reach the Moon. It's by Mike Wall, published about 10 hours ago, so it's published June 28th. And the subtitle is Capstone Launch Today, June 28th. But won't arrive in lunar orbit until November 13th. So anybody that's interested in this could look at it itself, because I want to go on to more things before I end the show. So, as I said to you before, astronomy is so much fun. I think I want to cover as many topics as I can. and the topic that I wanted to cover was the capstone. Oh, I wanted to read about some of the rockets that are going to take spacecraft and people to the moon, and maybe eventually in a couple of decades or whenever it happens, to Mars. I didn't think rockets would be this interesting, but when I read that article that exposed me to the technology inside the rockets and how they were first tested and the problems that arose and then how they had to engineer it so the rockets wouldn't explode. And of course, no one wants an exploding rocket. So I'm going to read this article now from NASA. It's called Artemis 1 WDR Update. Test ends at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at T29 seconds. The Artemis 1 wet dress rehearsal ended today at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at T29 seconds in the countdown. Today's test marked the first time the teams fully loaded all the Space Launch System rockets, propellant tanks, and proceeded into the terminal launch countdowns when many critical activities occur in rapid succession. So as mentioned earlier in an article I read about maybe 20 minutes ago, half an hour ago, the new rockets for the Space Launch System are going to be probably bigger than the Apollo rockets or more powerful. And I don't know if there's working rockets like that now that could bring people to the moon or spacecraft to the moon. So for me, an interesting article. To me, it's almost imperative to read because I want to find out more about rockets. During propellant, the rockets of the future, that is, during propellant loading operations earlier in the day, launch controllers encountered a hydrogen leak in the quick disconnect that attaches an umbilical from the tail service mass on the mobile launcher to the rocket's core stage. The team attempted to fix the leak by warming the quick disconnect and then chilling it back down to realign a seal, but their efforts did not fix the issue. Launch controllers then developed a plan to mask data associated with the leak that would trigger a hold by the ground launch sequences or launch computer in a real launch day scenario to allow them to get as far into the countdown as possible. The time required to develop their plan required extended hold time during the countdown activities, but they were able to resume with the final 10 minutes of the countdown, called terminal count. During the terminal count, the teams performed several critical operations that must be accomplished for launch, including switching control from the ground launch sequence to the automated launch sequence controlled by the rocket's flight software, and important step that the team wanted to accomplish. So if you think a mission like, for example, the ones on Mars now, or any mission, there's the equipment on board. For example, the James Webb Space Telescope has these four instruments on board, and they're all complicated, and the how to unfold the Webb telescope is complicated, how to get it to its proper position in the sky at Lagrangian point 2, all these things. But then another thing is the launch, and this is complicated itself as I'm reading it, all these technical things that must be done. NASA will hold a media teleconference about the test Tuesday, June 21 at 11 a.m. So that was last week. I'm sorry, I'm reading last week's article, which will stream on the agency's website. A live feed on the rocket at launch continues to be available. So thank you for listening today. There's so many, as I said, there's so many things from designing Webb on the ground to getting it on the rocket and then flying it into space, that's a complicated thing, and then getting it to its point at L2, then starting to unfold the mirror, and then getting all the things tested and operational. So I think they said their first pictures will come July 12th, and it's a big process. And the launch is, of course, it gets it off the ground, and just to get it up in there safe. Imagine if something went wrong during the launch or the rocket explode, then the $10 billion that was put into Webb is gone. So the launch is such an important thing, and we know that astronauts keep going to the space station, International Space Station, and cosmonauts and other people from the Japanese Space Agency, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency. Canadians have gone into space too. So the launch is such an important thing, and landing and the rockets themselves, it's a wonder to discover how they work and all the things that had to happen to get them to this point, because when some of the early rockets, of course, they blow up much more frequently, and just to get them operational and discover how to do it without getting them to explode, that's a good story to read itself. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have listened to AstroTalk for June 30th, 2022. And if I didn't do this, then be poor manners, but have a happy Canada Day. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Yo, it's a Boshi. Okay. I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do? Take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double D's. You know what I like? Ice cold killer with my eye on the prize. Give good face. You were just my type. Did a double take when you saw me on the mic. Cut it up and chill it out. Pass that pipe. Looking at you up and down. Man, I just might. A bag full of bones. You know how I feel when I say I'm alone. You know what I want when I say I'm at home. Whip to the spot round quarter past 10. Don't say lies when I ask where you been. Don't say truth when I try to pretend. Maybe you do want to deck up gems, diamonds, take you to the spot in the bands. You know how I act when I'm with my friends. Condescend to apprehend the tense. Spend a few racks just to act real cruel. Act real cute when I see it in the mood. Foolish when I try to get you in the nude. Cupid, have me walking far in the mules. Devil in the new dress, drop out of school. Baby, you know what I like to do. What I like to say when I bend all the rules. I was on the back of your mind, I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car, you were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do, take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin, don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant, don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was on the back of your mind, I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car, you were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do, take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin, don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant, don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? Come to the edge of the night, come to the start of your life. I'm at the edge of a knife. I wanna see you, I wanna see you. Come to the edge of the night, come to the start of your life. I'm on the edge of a knife, I'm at the start of a fight. I wanna see you, I wanna see you. I was on the back of your mind, I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car, you were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do, take things too far. Take things too far. You know what I do, I take things too far. I take things too far. Come to the edge of the night, come to the start of your life. I'm on the edge of a knife, I'm at the start of a fight. I wanna see you, I wanna see you.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sa, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. I would like to begin by thanking you all for tuning in to our very first episode. From the bottom of my heart, it truly means